there are all kinds of people in the workforce, and it's natural not to get along with everyone. But it is essential to figure out how to work with even the most difficult people. So today, workplace expert Amy Gallo joins me to unpack the various types of difficult people and what you can do to work more effectively with each of them. Amy is the author of Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People, and the HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict, as well as hundreds of articles for Harvard Business Review. She's also the co-host of HBR's popular Women at Work podcast, which examines the struggles and successes of women in the workplace. Podcast Plus members also get the extended interview where Amy shares how we can make sure we're not bringing bias into our interpretation of someone's behavior, as well as what to do when you notice your team members having issues working together. Now here's the conversation. Are you a manager, boss, or team leader who aspires to level up and unleash your team's full potential? You're listening to the Modern Manager Podcast, and I'm your host, Mamie Canfer-Stewart. Each week, I explore effective strategies and provide actionable insights that supercharge your management abilities, optimize team performance, and foster a healthy workplace culture. Become a rockstar manager and help your team thrive at themodernmanager.com/more. Thank you so much for joining me today, Amy. I'm very excited to talk about how to work with everybody and how specifically how to work with difficult people, because I think almost every person I know has had that experience of working with someone that they just don't get along with, or there's some sort of frictions and something is challenging in the dynamic in the office and the relationship. Like, no one is immune from this. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you look at, there's like a ton of surveys of people. How many people work with someone who they find difficult? And I'm always amazed that it's anything less than 100, because it's just the universal experience, right?
Yes, actually, I remember very, very early on in my career, someone described it as sandpaper. That like there's just, it's like, it's a totally normal thing that like there's sandpaper all around and sometimes you rub up against it. And like, that's just part of the work experience, is you're gonna like get a little bit of sandpaper in your life. Yeah, I wanna know, who are these people who've never had to work with someone difficult?
Yeah, I'm always like, I want to meet that 5% who said they've never worked with someone they found challenging.
Yes. Okay. So maybe just to start us off, can you lay out the different kinds of difficult coworkers that people might experience and just share a little bit about each of them, just so we can all kind of have in our minds, we're not just talking about the person who is the jerk, but like the different variations of jerk, maybe if we could say it that way.
Yeah. And this is something I felt really passionate about doing with my book, was trying to make sure that people are getting specific advice for the type of behavior they were dealing with, right? How you deal with someone who's a pessimist is going to be different than how you deal with someone who's passive aggressive. So I came up with 8 archetypes. These were based on the most frequent stories, experiences, some surveys I had done. They're not mutually exclusive, meaning you might have someone who doesn't fit into any of those categories, or you might have someone who fits into multiple of them. But to quickly just go through the 8, the first is the insecure boss. That's someone who, you know, isn't actually secure in their competence or their confidence. And they then take that out on the people they manage, usually by micromanaging, questioning their trustworthiness, maybe hoarding resources or not allowing you to go to meetings. You then have the pessimist. This is sort of self-evidence, the person who just thinks things are always going to go wrong. They shoot down ideas. They point out all the risks. They generally bring sort of a dark cloud over meetings, which is can really ruin the mood. Then there's a victim who is a sort of flavor of the pessimist. They also think things are going to go wrong, but they think they go wrong just to them. You know, I like to say they're sort of Teflon for responsibility. Part of the sort of victim mentality is, I shouldn't have to do anything because I'm just treated so unfairly. Then you have the passive-aggressive peer, someone who says one thing and does one thing but actually means another. They're often afraid, unsure, hesitant to express their ideas and thoughts in a straightforward manner, so they do it in an indirect way. You then have the know-it-all. This is the person who claims to know things with absolute certainty that they really have no reason to believe they should know for sure. They tend to interrupt, talk over people, just sort of have this sort of arrogant and often condescending attitude. You then have the tormentor, which is one of my least favorites, to be honest. This is someone who is usually in a senior position. You expect them to be a mentor. because maybe they are higher up in the organization than you. Maybe you share an identity factor like your gender or race and you expect them to look after you, but they do the exact opposite and undermine you. You then have the biased coworker. This is someone who, you know, sort of targets you with microaggressions. You know, we're all biased, of course, but this person really tries to undermine you, maybe intentionally or not, by pointing out ways in which you're different. And then lastly, you have the political operator. And this is the person who is dead set on getting ahead. Does not matter who gets in the way. They usually try to boost their career, often at the expense of others.
I'm listening and I'm like thinking about all the people that I worked with and I'm like, who falls into which category here? So I feel like one of the experiences that I've had most often is almost more like a personality clashing where someone is a stickler for details and I'm just like, we can figure that out later. And right, like they're like, how do you categorize or kind of what bucket of strategies would you have put someone like that where you're just like at odds constantly because maybe you're approaching something differently and it just makes it really hard to get anything done?
This is a common issue and I actually wouldn't necessarily put them in one of the categories. It depends how they respond to the tension, right? So, you know, if it's someone who you have a different style and they just keep saying that style won't work, that approach won't work, right? They might be a pessimist. If they're like, okay, fine, we'll do it your way, they might be passive aggressive. But the question's an important one because I think what often happens, you know, I actually believe conflict in the workplace is an important thing. I think we actually don't disagree enough. And those differences in style, like the, you know, someone who's focused on speed versus someone who's focused on all of the details, those are good tensions to have as long as you can focus on what's best for the organization or what's best for this goal or what's best for our team, as to opposed to turning it into a personality clash. And I think oftentimes we think we're dealing with someone difficult when really we just have a different way of approaching things and we don't have the skills or they don't have the skills to disagree in a constructive way that can lead to sort of an outcome that's best for everyone.
It's such a helpful reframing and understanding and the nuance of it's not just the interaction, but it's also the kind of what follows that is important to understand. Can you maybe walk us through the process of trying to understand where these behaviors might be coming from and kind of and how we can just from at least a first layer approach trying to figure out what's really happening with a colleague who's acting in one of these ways?
I really encourage people to ask that question, like what is actually motivating this person? What could be a rational reason for the way that they're behaving? Because our instinct when someone is pushing our buttons or sort of we're you know coming up against that friction with someone who is immediately to think, oh, they're a jerk or they're rude or right. We start sort of getting these dismissive labels because it's painful, right? It often challenges our ego or our sense of self. And so it can be really hard to not do that. And instead, I think it's helpful to ask what's going on? What actually is that person trying to achieve? Or oftentimes with many of the archetypes, it's about insecurity. It's about their own ego. It's trying to prove that they're worthwhile. Think about the know-it-all, right? Even the pessimist is often someone who is brokering in power dynamics because we often afford a pessimist more power than we do someone who's optimistic. So it's often that people are trying to prove something, trying to compensate for an insecurity. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We all do these things. And, you know, when you were saying I was listing those archetypes and you're thinking, oh, where would this person fit? Where oftentimes people tell me they listen to that list and think, oh, gosh, I fit into one of those, right? And that's the truth is none of us is above this behavior. And I think we have to remember that. So thinking about what is the behavior that's problematic, like someone being a pessimist, sure, it can be annoying, but what's the problematic behavior? Are they shooting down ideas in a meeting so that no one speaks up? Okay, that's problematic. Now, why might they do that? And part of that, you know, understanding why helps you sometimes have a different approach or a different attitude toward them, and it can shift the dynamic, but it also gives you cues as to how to actually respond, right? So if you get the sense someone's behaving like a know-it-all because they feel deeply insecure, you can find ways to reassure them that their position is stable or that people really trust them, as opposed to sort of digging them into that hole of insecurity, which we often do because we retaliate and we get frustrated and we try to shut them down, which only sort of feeds that behavior.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering if you can give us a story about kind of what a typical behavior maybe of a client or someone who kind of was approaching something in a way that, you know, wasn't working, and then what the shift was and the impact of making those kinds of changes and approaching with that sense of empathy.
Yeah, so there was actually, I'm thinking about a coaching client I worked with several years ago who was struggling with someone who I would put into this sort of know-it-all category. He was really condescending. When people came up with new ideas, he would often be like, I don't know, I don't even know why you think that would work, right? And he was very abrasive in both in-person meetings, but also via email and Slack, right? He wasn't careful in his communication. And she just assumed that he was a jerk, right? She just assumed he was arrogant and he, you know, was doing this because he thought he knew better than everyone. And instead of, you know, having any sort of curiosity about what was going on with him, she really put up this wall. Anytime he was rude, she was rude back. She just sort of felt like, I'm going to fight fire with fire. It didn't really work, to be honest, and their relationship really deteriorated, but she needed to work with him. There was no choice given the way the organization and the team was structured. So one of the things I encouraged her to do, I said, you know what? I know you think he's just universally a jerk and everyone sees him that way, but I bet there's someone in the organization who enjoys working with him. Find that person and go find out what they respect about him. And, you know, of course, I didn't want her to do this in a gossipy way of like, oh gosh, what do you think of Eric? That's not his real name. But like, what, you know, to go and say, I know Eric is a valuable member of this team. What do you enjoy about working with him? And she got some really interesting insight from this person she approached, which is who said, he's constantly moving fast. He's a quick thinker. He's an innovator. He doesn't have patience for communication. So oftentimes he can be abrasive, but if you really get to know him, he's an incredibly sweet guy. And my client actually was like, okay, I'm going to take that at face value. She put some time and effort. She took him out to coffee. She tried to sit next to him during meetings. Like, she just sort of tried to just sort of get to know him a little bit better. She still did not like his attitude. He didn't change dramatically, but her sort of interpretation of it changed. And because she was no longer fighting fire with fire, he did soften a little bit. And even this was a huge win for her, is that when he was rude to her on Slack or sort of a public, like an email where people were CC'd, he would apologize afterwards and would say, I can see that wasn't rude. I'm sorry. I was moving too fast. That just, it helped change their dynamic. You know, she will never, if I called her today, I know she would say he was not my favorite person to work with, right? And that's the thing. We're not looking to go from like arch enemies to BFFs. Like, we're just looking to neutralize the relationship so it causes you less stress in the moment.
Wow. I mean, okay. So you just said so many important things there, right? First, which is like the goal is to be in a neutral zone with a lot of folks, right? The goal is not to transform the relationship into something so special and beautiful and wonderful, but really just to be in a place where we can do our work, they can do their work, and we can work together effectively without the stress. Second, that the reframing and kind of our part, right? You talked about how like she was fighting with fire with fire, and that was making it worse. And that, you know, we have to think about how our behavior might be contributing to the dynamic. It's not just them. So I want to go back into that in a second. Thirdly, this element of email and Slack, I feel like we just have to dive into like the digital communication space, because so much happens there that is very different than what happens in conversation face to face people. So why don't we start with like our role, and can you just say more about how we need to be thinking about our part in a relationship?
Hey there, Mamie here. Just a quick and exciting update for all of you who are enjoying the Modern Manager podcast. The Modern Manager membership community is getting a minor makeover, and it is now called the Podcast Plus membership. And you can sign up for it and join a community of managers determined to do better every day. You'll get full access to our Slack channel, sketch notes with key takeaways from each episode, all types of guest bonuses, and the members-only podcast, which is ad-free and has extended interviews. So you get to hear the answers to my juiciest questions without interruptions like this one. Sign up today for $15 per month at themodernmanager.com/more. I can't wait to see you there.
I mean, I really like to think of a challenging interaction at work as a collaboration, right? I think we often see it as a battle, but if you think about it as a collaboration, there's you, there's the other person, and there's the problem you're trying to solve. That problem you're trying to solve might be how you treat one another, how you, with the tone in your emails, it might be, you know, something bigger. But I think if you see yourself as a collaborator with that other person, then you can understand that this is not about them and their personality, which you're not going to change. Even if the true problem, even if we could, you know, survey 100 people you work with and everyone said, yep, she's the problem, right? She's not necessarily going to change her entire personality. So what you can change often is the way you interact and the way you contribute to the situation. And, you know, that phrase, it takes two to tango, is true, right? You're trying to adjust the dynamic, not trying to reform this person. And you are probably contributing to that dynamic in some way. Now, I don't want people to take responsibility fully for, especially if they're dealing with someone who's really, you know, really problematic or really toxic. Like, it's not on you to fix that necessarily. But remember, it's what you can control. So if you ask yourself, how am I contributing to this? What if I change the way I interact with them? Does that actually improve things in any way? And does it actually cost you much, right? Oftentimes when I'm encouraging people to make behavior change to deal with someone else in a better way, it's not because I think they have to, it's their responsibility, but I'm also thinking it probably doesn't cost you much to just tweak your behavior slightly, and it might reap really good benefits for their relationship.
Is there a part of this that is confronting the other person with the impact their behavior is having on you? Is that a strategy that we like need to make them aware of? Because I know, like, when I coach people on meetings, especially, I'm like, most people don't realize that they're hogging the mic. Most people don't realize that they're talking over you, right? Most people are so unaware of their behaviors. And sometimes a simple pointing it out is enough to get them to change. Is that something we should be considering doing, or should we really focus more on ourselves?
Yes, is the short answer. Yes, we should be considering a direct conversation. I think that there's sort of a range of tactics that go from indirect, sort of changing your behavior, maybe reframing the way you say something to them, or maybe even sort of bringing in someone else who can sort of neutralize the situation, right? Things that are not as direct. And then you, on the other end of the spectrum, you have the sort of real sit-down conversation of like, hey, every time we meet with this group, you interrupt me. And I'm really worried it's undermining my credibility with the group. Would it be okay for you to hold off on what you have to say until I'm finished talking? A very direct, open conversation can help. There's a couple things to keep in mind, though. The direct conversation, one, what we know is from research that it often depends on your own identity and the power dynamic with the other person. So we allow people from certain groups, men, for example, or people who are from a dominant group, like white people at work, to be more assertive in that way. We tend to penalize people who are from underestimated groups or from underrepresented groups for being as assertive. And we have often descriptive labels for people who are from less powerful identities who tend to be assertive. So you have to sort of keep that in mind, I think. And you also have to keep in mind how receptive. Like, I can think of the 10 challenging people who immediately come to mind in my career. You know, there's a good 4 of them that a direct conversation would have absolutely backfired, and I would have been really suffering as a result. But there's a good number of them who I was able to say, you know, here's how your behavior is impacting me. I don't think it's your intention, but could we work on this dynamic? And with good results, often, you know, it did help. So,
yeah, I think that's such an important point to remember, that we should be thinking about the potential upsides and downsides of how the person's going to respond and what we can manage given our power dynamic, given their past behavior. I had a client who had confronted her boss, and of course the boss, like, sadly turned everything around on her and, like, made everything her fault, and she felt so gaslit, and she was like, I was trying to, like, make it better and it just made it worse. And, like, and that's hard, right? We definitely don't want to set ourselves up for that kind of experience.
Exactly. And I think that that's exactly, you know, you're constantly weighing the pros and cons of different approaches. The one thing I will say is I think we often overestimate how reactive someone's going to be. And we also assume that that reaction in the moment means that the conversation didn't go well. But sometimes you have a really tough conversation and the person still heard you, even if they didn't react well, and they may change their behavior over time. But, you know, to your client's example, there's also moments of retaliation, and you have to know who you're dealing with before you sort of approach that more direct conversation.
Yeah, and know what you can be resilient against.
Right? Exactly.
All right, let's talk about the digital, like email, Slack messages. Like, it seems like a lot of stuff kind of comes out in writing or kind of in these asynchronous forms. Can you speak a little bit about how to navigate all that junk that happens?
Yes. Well, and I think one of the things you just have to remember, we all know this, but we forget it because we use these technological tools all day long to communicate. This medium, whether it's text, right, whether it's Slack, whether it's email, is ripe for miscommunication and misunderstanding. You cannot convey the same amount of nuance in written word that you can with facial expressions, body language, just sort of picking up on someone's energy. And so, there's a social psychology concept called naive realism, where we actually think we're being perfectly clear. We think we're seeing the situation, right? Because we have the thought track in our head, and then we just write the 10 words out, and we're like, well, they'll know exactly what I mean. But then they're layering their own experience on it, right? So it's just, you have to remind yourself, it's ripe for miscommunication, misunderstanding. So I have to try to be as clear as possible. And sometimes I have to actually be clear about what my intention is or my motivation is. Like, my point with this email is to clarify what happened in the meeting last week, not to, you know, continue the discussion or whatever it is. You want to make clear what you're actually trying to do. And if things get heated or tense, I cannot recommend enough just removing yourselves from that medium and picking up the phone. I know lots of people are allergic to the phone, but like getting on a video call, if you can see that person physically in person, I just encourage it, because I think it just, the other piece about these digital communication tools is they don't encourage empathy, right? When I'm texting on my phone, I'm not looking someone in the eye. I'm not seeing them as a human. I'm seeing them as a task I have to get done. And that really, I think, changes the way we interact with one another. And it can really set us up for having these really disjointed, transactional, and sometimes really sort of trigger-inducing conversations.
I'm wondering about a couple of different strategies that I've heard some folks use, some folks like, some folks don't like. Things like including emojis to try to convey that you are sending this with a happy thing, even if you're asking something tough, or, you know, so you're trying to like convey a little bit of that emotion with something a little more playful and emotive. What do you think about that?
I actually remember the first time I ever got an email with an emoji. Like, it was just the colon and the parentheses, a smiley face. It was from the senior partner at a management consulting firm I worked at. And I remember thinking, oh, I guess it's okay to send emojis and professional emails now. This was years ago. And I also just really appreciated it, because I think if it's a genuine, here's the tone I intend with this email, I think it can really help. I think if you're saying something really harsh and you add a smiley emoji, like, you have to watch for the passive aggressiveness that can come out. But if you're genuinely trying to just show this is lighthearted, I'm torn about this, right? But just remember that it's not going to convey. Like, you can have as many exclamation points, smiley faces, emojis in the email, it's still not going to convey that same nuance. So it's a good, I like it as a tool. I actually am a fan of emojis in email, limited. I try to keep it to one per email. But I think that we have to just recognize it's still not, it's not a substitute for seeing someone face to face.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I'm so glad you said that we can put emojis in emails now, because I also love emojis, especially you have an example in the book around this with like a text where, you know, it's just kind of like whatever you want. And sometimes you can read that and it's like, are you just telling me like, fine, like, well, whatever you want, like, I'm going to hold it against you, but like, okay. Or are you actually truly saying, no, like, whatever you want is fine with me, completely fine. And I feel like that's where like the emoji can convey the difference very clearly, as long as you're actually not intending to be passive aggressive and writing whatever you want with a smiley face. And really in the back of your mind, you're like, ha ha, I got you tricked now.
Exactly. You think I'm nice when I'm being mean, right?
That's right. Okay. Next tactic. So what do you think about audio messages and video messages and just like moving in general away from so much text in our communications right now?
I'm a fan. I have to say, like, I have, I don't remember the name of the tool, but I have a colleague I work with who will often send me video feedback on something. So he'll bring it up on the screen and he'll walk me through his feedback. And I find it so helpful because, again, it gives me a little bit of more nuance of like, actually, how does he feel about this? I can read into that, his tone a little bit. It feels connected. It feels like I'm dealing with a human as opposed to just a bunch of words. It does require a little extra effort for someone to listen to an audio message or to watch a video. So you have to keep that in mind. Like, is this something that really can just be a quick, simple email? But if it's not, if it's something that's a little more complicated that maybe is a little sensitive, like giving someone feedback on something they've worked on, I love it as a tool because it just sort of elevates the sort of frequency or the sort of the dynamism of the conversation in a way that can be helpful.
When you get an email or a message of some sort and you feel like the person is being rude or disrespectful or criticizing you or something that feels unwarranted, what should we do with that?
First, you should close whatever, your phone, your laptop, whatever it is, just do something else for a little while, because our first reaction is often a heated one, especially if we feel a little moment of threat or sort of dismissiveness or disregard. And what happens when we have, there's another psychology concept called premature cognitive commitment. So if you, Mamie, send me an email and I think it's rude, I'm immediately, Mamie's a jerk, right? And it just becomes, and then I just start gathering evidence. I'm like, oh, remember that time she sent me that other email, right? And I become committed to this idea that you're a jerk. Whereas if I think, ooh, ouch, that hurt. Okay, let me give myself a break. Come back to it. Say, okay, what else could be going on here, right? What else might account for Mamie's tone or the shortness of this email or whatever it is? I think that can help us not sort of immediately become wedded to the story we want to tell ourselves about the situation, which is often this person's horrible and I'm great, right? We're all prone to do that. And then I think if you really still feel like, ooh, this was not good, this is a chance. I don't think you should email back, because it's just then, I mean, I've been like 75 emails deep into a conversation where I'm like, why did I not just ask them for a video call or pick up the phone, right? But I think if you can let it go and still continue the conversation to get to the goal, great. If you can't, I think it's time to pick up the phone and just say, I have to tell you that email didn't land with me. What's going on? And or like my first reaction to that email was that you're angry, or my first reaction was to become angry. I know that's not helpful here, and it's probably not what you intended. Can we talk it through? Right? Just accusing someone of like that email was rude. Then you get into a whole debate about what's rude. What did they intend? Right? Allowing them that this probably wasn't their intention, but this was the impact on you, opens up a totally different conversation.
Oh my gosh, I'm like kicking myself right now from an email exchange where it was like the flurry of back and forth where like they sent me something, it made me angry, I sent them something, and then they sent me something, and it was a back and forth, and it was just so unhelpful. And I'm like, oh, I should have just picked up the phone, yep. Right? But in those moments, it's hard to pull back. And I remember the last email I sent, so passive aggressive. It was like, I think what you meant to say was, I'm sorry about the change of plans and that it, you know, cause an issue for you. I will try to inform you earlier in the future.
I love that. You rewrote their email for them.
I mean,
so passive aggressive. It's amazing. Did it work? Was there any response?
Well, there was no response back. And so I was like, I hope that they got the message, but it was definitely not my finest moment. So it's a good reminder that, you know, we all have to work on ourselves and the way that we, as we were saying earlier, contribute to the situation and what we can do differently to make our lives and our colleagues' lives a little easier. So, all right, we have to wrap up. So, okay. Amy, can you tell us about a great manager that you worked for and what made this person such a fabulous boss?
I'm going to cheat a little here because I actually had a manager who was a good friend before I worked for her. So I already had sort of a predisposition to like her. However, what was interesting, we actually had to be very boundaried about our relationship because obviously we didn't want our friendship to be affected and we didn't want there to be any sense of favoritism or unprofessionalness between us. But I just gained so much respect for her as a manager, as I worked for her, mostly because she was incredibly empowering. She sort of trusted us to come up with ideas, try them out, report back to her. Like she was the opposite of a micromanager in the best way. And in fact, I remember, I wrote about this in an article I did about psychological safety, because I remember this one experience where she had sort of empowered me to propose this idea, to try out this initiative. We put a bunch of resources into this project and it did not work. And I had to sort of share with her the data showing that we weren't getting the return that we expected. And I expected her to be mad. I would have been mad if I were in her situation. And she sort of listened and she did have like a stern look on her face, but she said at the end, "Well, what did you learn?" And it was just such a great question of like when someone comes to you with a mistake or with a setback, instead of what went wrong, how could you have done differently? Just like, or what are you going to do to make it right? Or, you know, just the question, what did you learn? Just put me in such a different mindset. And that was her attitude about everything. It's like, yeah, mistakes happen. Let's learn from them and just keep getting better.
So amazing. And where can people learn more about you? And I have to give out a huge shout out to your book. I highly, highly, highly recommend everybody read it because there's so much depth and so many good tips, very practical. So tell us, what is your book? Where can we find it and keep up with your work?
So it's called Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People. It's available anywhere you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Any independent bookstore should have it as well. You can also find order links on my website, which is the best place to connect with me. It's Amy E. Gallo, so AmyEGallo.com. I have a twice a month newsletter where I talk about relationships at work, difficult interactions, the psychology of work, anything having to do with sort of resilience and psychology. So you can also sign up on my website to get those emails.
Awesome. Highly recommend it for everyone. So thank you again, Amy. Really, I'm already learning so much. I love this.
Thank you, Amy. This has been a really fun conversation.
Amy is giving away two copies of her book, Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People, to members of Podcast Plus. In this book, Amy identifies 8 familiar types of difficult coworkers and provides strategies tailored to dealing constructively with each one. She also shares principles that will help you turn things around no matter who you're at odds with. You must enter the drawing by Wednesday, May 1st. To get this guest bonus and many more, become a member at themodernmanager.com/more. All the links are in the show notes and they can be delivered to your inbox when you subscribe to my newsletter. Find that at themodernmanager.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.